911, what's your emergency?
Yeah, my next-door neighbor broke into my house and stole my drugs.
911, what?
A fun, unique podcast taking you behind the badge. Unbelievable stories exploring the day in the life of a first responder. 911 is made possible by Carlos Bail Bonding and Eric Buchanan and Associates, fighting for those who have been denied disability, life, long-term care, and health benefits nationwide. Now, here's your host, DeMarlon Dean.
Welcome to 911. So, you can tell already that I'm a little bit under the weather, but there was no way that I was going to try to reschedule my interview with this guy, because I have on the line with me today Sergeant John Mattingly. So that name may sound familiar to you. And if so, it's because his name is now recognized with the Breonna Taylor case. But there's a lot more to Sergeant Mattingly than just this Breonna Taylor case. And we're going to talk a lot about that, about what he's done leading up to that tragedy, and how it's changed his life since then. So, you know, with 20 years on the Louisville Metro Police Department, he's done all kinds of assignments during that time. And you know what, I'm just going to turn it over to you, John, and let you kind of tell us your history and your progression through the Louisville Metro Police Department. Thank you so much for joining us, sir.
DeMarlon, appreciate you having me, man. So I came on in June of 2000, and I went to late watch, which is our midnight to 8 a.m. shift. Did that for about 5 years. And then, you know, my body was starting to wear down. Plus, I wanted to do something different. You know, every few years, it's good to change it up. So there was a flex unit opening, which is basically it's a small narcotics unit inside each division. We have 8 divisions in Louisville Metro. And it also does any of the needs of the major of that department, whether it be, you know, high robberies, prostitution, whatever the complaints are. But usually about 90% of the complaints, because most crimes derive off narcotics, were narcotics complaints. So I did that for 4 years, 4.5 years, and in late 2009 was promoted to sergeant, went back to late watch for a year, did that. My body again was going, man, you're getting too old for this stuff. You've been off of it too long. So I went to our district detective sergeant spot. It opened up. I went there for about 1.5 years, did it, had a good time, learned a lot of things, but suit and tie, sitting behind a desk, plugging away at a computer, just wasn't me. And so I went back to the flex unit in that division as a sergeant, only did that for a few months, and the crime in the city had just spiked, and they decided to start a new violent crime unit, which went after murderers, shooters, carjackers, and mainly just gangbang type things. Did that from 2012 to the end of 2015. And then in 2016, I went over to our narcotics unit, which is where I'd always wanted to be anyway in my career. And I did that up until 2020 during the Breonna Taylor incident. And then, you know, the course of my life and everything kind of changed after that.
Yeah, I hear you. And when you were a suit, what type of detective were you?
Well, I was the sergeant over district detective. So they handled everything from non-life-threatening shootings to, again, carjackings, burglaries, robberies, that type of thing in a division.
Gotcha. And then which of your assignments of all of those was your favorite?
It had to be the Viper unit, which was the violent crime unit, because I had a group of guys that, and I've always had, you know, pretty good guys working under me, because as a sergeant, you know, you might get the glory or say, man, your unit's great, but you're basically a guy holding the reins, trying to lead guys in the right direction and keep them out of trouble, keep yourself out of trouble. And, but the Viper unit, man, these guys, they were mostly younger guys who were super aggressive, and had a couple older guys mixed in with it that had the experience and had the connections and all the outreach with informants and all that. And so we would come to work at like 2 p.m. We wouldn't get home till 3 or 4 a.m. And from the time we stepped foot in to the time we went home, it was just, you know, full throttle. And we do 2 warrants a night. So it was just busy. And while it was the hardest job I've ever done on the department, it was the most fun I had.
So just blowing and going all night long.
That was it, man. I mean, we were lucky if we'd swing through a Taco Bell at midnight and grab something to eat, because we missed dinner because we were just so busy. And it's sad to say, because there's that much crime out there.
That's true. That's true. And I, you know, Louisville's not really on my radar, like, you know, St. Louis, but it's a pretty big city. What size city is Louisville?
It's right at 1 million people. Some say a little bit over, some say a little under. In the inner city, it was about 750,000. Then when you go out to the suburbs, you're a little bit over 1 million. And I'll tell you what, homicides per capita, we're 3 times more than Chicago. We had almost 200 last year. We had over 800 shootings. And this year we're going to even, you know, encapsulate that and make it look like nothing. So right now I saw a stat the other day. I'm no longer in the department, obviously, but I saw a stat the other day that said we'd be one or two for the size of our city ranked in homicides this year if we keep at the pace we're at.
That is crazy. No, I had no idea. You know, let me ask you, in your 20 years in, lots of things have changed. How would you say the crime now compares to what it used to be back in 2000 when you came on board?
Man, a lot of things changed. And I'll tell you, DeMarlo, when we saw the change, it was in Obama's second administration. And it wasn't him specifically. It's just things just started changing then. I can't really put my finger on it. But it was around 2013, 14, things just started, actually a little bit before that, probably about 2012, everything just started picking up. And then you had Michael Brown. And after that, man, things just, you know, went to hell in a handbasket. And we recouped some, you know, there's always that pendulum that swings back and forth. But we've never really gotten back to where it was, you know, when we first started. And I think, you know, people say body cams and cell phones hold police more accountable. And they do to some cops, because let's face it, they're bad cops. We're dealing with human beings that are flawed, that they have issues. But I think what it's done is it's emboldened the criminals, because, you know, they'll come up and get in your face and try to provoke you and do things. And so I'm not sure. I can't put my finger right on it, but I know the time frame was around 2012, 13. Then in 2015, everything just went, you know, really sideways. And then we saw it again in 2020. You know, things just came off the hinges.
Yeah, we're just seeing a lot of, I don't know, lack of respect for authority just in general. And it's sad. And, you know, you've touched on some things. You know, there are some bad cops. As I was reading through some of your interviews, one thing that you said was, historically speaking, we probably are in the best place that we've been as far as the actual character of police, because let's face it, when you look historically, the Black community in particular, there's been some legitimate issues, bad issues.
Yeah.
And,
no doubt.
You know, people can't say, well, now this has happened, so you just forget about that. Everybody's good. So there's going to be some distrust, and there has to be a lot of transparency to help overcome that. And I think transparency is one of the things that you even mentioned that was missing, I'm going to try not to keep apologizing for having hiccups, but that's one of the things that probably led to a lot of the unrest and that followed the actual incident.
Yeah. I mean, this, our mayor is super progressive guy, and that's irrelevant as long as you're doing the right thing. You know, as long as you put out what the majority of the citizens want, need, what's good for the city you live in or the country you live in, then I don't care what side of the fence you're on, as long as you're doing the right thing. And our mayor is really big on, one of his buzzwords has always been, well, we want to be the most transparent we've ever been. Well, this guy, unfortunately, in his first couple of years, he was great. I actually liked him. But he's been in there for 12 years now, and it seems like the longer these guys hold office, the worse they become. I don't care if it's state level, local level, federal level. These guys become very complacent. They feel, you know, like they're untouchable, and there was zero transparency in this, and that caused a lot of people to question things. And from the outside looking in, I would question it too if I didn't know the facts, because here you had almost 2 years of all these lies being put out and the department not being transparent, or city not being transparent. And if nobody's rebutting those, then you sit back and go, wait a minute, they paid the family $12 million. They're saying all these accusations. Nobody's going, hey, wait a minute, that's not true. So what do we think? Well, they must be guilty. They must have done it, everything they said. And that's the sad part about it, because, you know, guys like me who don't have a voice and the other guys involved, you get these gag orders put on. You get these threats that if you talk, they won't cover you in the lawsuits. And you know you're going to lose. Regardless if you're in the right or not, you're going to lose these lawsuits in court, because there's such an emotional appeal attached to all this stuff. And part of that's due to what you're talking about, historical stuff that happened that we've got to overcome. And unfortunately, you know, there's several million interactions a week with citizens and police. And all you see is those 3 or 4 a year that look really bad, whether they're bad or not, even the perception of them that look really bad. And those things get hammered on. And that's what sticks in people's mind. It's just like a business. You know, you can go out and you can do things right every day of the year, and that one day you screw up and do something wrong, that bad news travels and you might lose business over it. And that's kind of where we're at in policing.
Yeah, I agree. And I encourage people to try to just take a step back and just let everything play out before they make a decision, whether, you know, pro cop, anti cop, pro bad guy, so to speak, whatever. You know, let's assume everybody is innocent. You know, that includes the police that you think just brutally murdered somebody. Let's assume everybody was innocent until all the facts play out. So let's go ahead and jump into the Breonna Taylor story. Just tell us how that day started and what the plan was, because I've learned some things. Like, you know, there were two search warrants. I only heard about a one no knock warrant, but that's not the case. So kind of tell us what happened from your side of the fence.
Well, actually there were five search warrants signed, and that was the point of the big manpower issue. So we had the criminal investigation division, which housed both narcotics and place-based investigation and another unit. I can't remember the name of it now, but if you were in your group and your narcotics, that's basically who you helped out in the, you know, the group you ran in. But this place-based investigation was a new unit formed by the city, pushed together by the mayor that they got from Cincinnati, a plan up there that targeted individuals or areas that got a lot of complaints or were super high crime. And they came in, and the very first task that the city gave them, per the mayor, per his adjutant, who was sent every single week to our office to meet with this group of individuals, was Elliott Avenue and Jamarcus Glover, which was Breonna Taylor's ex-boyfriend, but the one that she still had ties to. And so now looking back, once you know all the details, you look at Jamarcus Glover and go, man, on the importance of criminals in the city of Louisville, this guy was way down here. I mean, he did what 1,000 other guys are doing daily. Not to say that what he's doing should have got off, but when you're targeting somebody, you have to sit back and go, okay, why is the city or why is the mayor so pushy on this one? What's the deal? Well, later we found out there was some degentrification going on. Back in 2018, they had already laid out plans for Elliott Avenue, this block, this two-city block, where they were going to tear down all the houses, rebuild it to this new nice thing with fountains and walkways, and it's right in the middle of the inner city. And I'm all for, you know, bringing our cities up, helping those that can't help themselves. But the way the city was going about doing it was using code and regulations to go in, hammer these landlords, and basically stealing these houses. They were getting them for like a dollar a piece because they would put so many liens on them, so many fines on them, and they're taking them. Well, they couldn't get these last couple of houses. So what did they do? They sick the police on them. And the police unwillingly, because we don't have privy to that stuff. Everybody thinks, well, if you're in the city government, you know all things. No, there's so many things that go on that the police, we're just one little unit inside this big organization. And when the mayor comes to the police department and goes, hey, I need you to do this, the police jump, right? So they went in, and their goal was to get enough citations on this place where they could shut it down. And now looking back, I thought, man, this mayor is so dirty. He used us unwittingly to do his dirty work so he could bring in all this money, so he could pat his little buddies on the back and give them the contracts and do all these, you know, behind the scene politician things that they do.
Follow the money.
And that's it. And you know, we were the downfall for it. And that's the whole reason he never would come out and give exactly what happened that night and the reason we were there and all that. He stayed far away from it. Because they settled the lawsuit in the middle of the night on a Sunday night without city council's approval. And the reason they did it was because two or three days prior to this, the attorney for Breonna Taylor's family found out about this gentrification. They found the plans. They found the map that had the X marks that the city owned and the ones that they needed. And they added that to the lawsuit. 2 or 3 days later, this thing settled in the dark of night so it would go away so he wouldn't have to testify.
Man, that's amazing.
So that just... Dude, it just shows you the corruption.
Yeah.
And this guy wants to stand up there and go, oh, we need justice for Breonna Taylor. Well, dude, you're the reason we were even there that
night. My goodness. You
know, it wasn't our decision. We had nothing to do with it. All they did was they put an email out saying, we've got five warrants going. We need some bodies. And I volunteered to help. The guys that were with me volunteered to help. There's only one guy that was with us that was part of that unit. The rest of them were volunteers. And so this brief happened on March 12th, which was a Thursday night, leading into Friday, March 13th, full moon, raining out, all these things like in the movies, yeah. Just like you would think. We show up at 10 o'clock that night for the brief. We go in. On the board are all the addresses. Every single one of them have no knock, no knock, no knock. You get to 3003 Springfield, which is Breonna's, and it said knock and announce. So I took my phone and I took a picture of the board because that's what I always did just to kind of cover your bases. So if you're out there and you forget something, you can look back at it. And so I'm like, well, why are we doing a knock and announce if all these others are no knock? Well, the no knock was for Jamarcus Glover because there's certain parameters you have to meet in order to have a no knock warrant. And this one no longer met those parameters because they had a tracker on his vehicle and a ping on his phone. They knew exactly where he was. They knew he was not going to be at Brianna's apartment. So in their mind, they thought, okay, it's only going to be Brianna there. They didn't know she had a new boyfriend. They said, no dogs, no kids. It's going to be easy. Never is easy when you say that. And they said, give her extra time to come to the door. She's a heavier set black female. Give her time to come to the door because our goal is not even to arrest her. We want to gather information from the house, seize any evidence we can, and go on our way. Because the goal was Jamarcus Glover and Elliot. This just played into it as far as paperwork and evidence. So we go there that night. I pull up. You know, I ride by first and I get know exactly what apartment I'm going to so we don't go to the wrong place. I go back, debrief with the guys, say, okay, I went by. This is what we're going to do. We come in, we approach the apartment. We get out and go up and start knocking on the door. I knocked the first time, didn't announce. Knocked the second time, didn't announce. Because the goal was to quietly get her to come to the door. That way we could just get in, do what we're doing, sight her if we needed to, and get on our way. So after two knocks, she didn't come. So then you go to the police knock, which everybody knows. It's the open hand, loud bang, man. Boom, boom, boom. Everybody in the neighborhood knows what that is. And then we start announcing, police search warrant. Please come to the door. Please search warrant. Well, the first time I did that, first time I started yelling that, the neighbor upstairs pops out and goes, what are y'all doing? So the guys downstairs address him. I'm staying focused on this door. They're addressing him. Son, get back in your apartment. Get back in your apartment. They argue for a minute. I finally go, hey, if he's not a threat, leave it alone. Let's stay focused on what we're doing. So we did this for about a minute, banging and announcing, please search warrant, please search warrant, come to the door. And right before the last time I knocked, the guy who was the breacher, who had the tool on the right, Mike, he said, hold on, I think I heard something inside. So we stop, we listen, and I yell again, if you're inside, come to the door, we got a search warrant. No response. I look back at my lieutenant, and he's like, all right, go ahead. That's when we start hitting the door to open it, because you can't stand out there forever. They're already working down on Elliot because they wanted these things simultaneous. So there were no phone calls and no evidence destroyed. So we start working the door. He hits it. He hits it a second time. The third time when he hits it, I'm on the left of it. He's on the right. The door swings from left to right. The third time I said, here it goes. Cause I could see through the door after the second hit. He hits it. It swings from left to right. I could see the living room on my right hand side as I clear it before I step into the doorway. And as soon as I run out of room where I can't see anymore, I step to my right so I can see down this long hallway. It's very dark in the apartment. There's a little bit of ambient light coming out from the bedroom. We've got gun-mounted rail lights on our pistols. And when I turn from left to right and I look down this hall, all I see is two figures overlapping one another. They're dark. It's the outline figure. If they were standing in front of me after this event, I couldn't have picked them out of a lineup because I couldn't identify the faces. But what I could identify when I went from right to left, panned, I stopped on Kenneth Walker because I saw the gun stretched out in his hand. My light hit it. I could see the tip of the gun, the barrel of the gun. And my mind's going, oh, crap, this ain't good. But everything's so quick. I mean, this is just like, boom, and it's over.
Yeah.
He shot. I return four rounds and I get behind the door frame to get offline. So if he continued shooting, I wouldn't get shot. Well, he had dove behind the door. There was a hallway and there was an inset in this hallway at the end. It's a very narrow hallway, about 3 foot. Brown is a bigger girl. He's not a small guy. As soon as he shot, he dove into this doorway to get out, left her hanging right in the middle of the hallway. And as I'm returning fire, she tried to follow him back into that bedroom. And that's when she got struck, unfortunately. And it was tragic because every cop's biggest nightmare is shooting someone that's innocent or shooting someone that's not actively aggressive toward you. And so when that happened, I reached out and I felt my leg and I could feel the blood. I could feel just a pool of blood in my palm. And I knew instantly this wasn't just a through and through. It was an artery hit. And I told the guys on scene, I went back and I was on my rear end. And I said, man, I've been hitting my leg. It's my femoral artery. And at that time, Miles had stepped up over me and was putting bullets down range so I could get out of the way. So I could scoop my rear end out of there. I get up, I hobble out, and I get in the parking lot. And I'm going, guys, I need a tourniquet. I need a tourniquet. Please give me a tourniquet. You know, hurry up. Find me one. Because I knew you have 5 to 8 minutes before you bleed out from these. And the hospital's about 25 minutes away. Even though we had EMS on standby, when I pulled up on scene to these guys, man, they were both maybe 20, 21. They were young. I knew they were inexperienced. And I remember making a comment to one of the guys when we were briefing. I went, man, I hope these guys ain't got to save our lives because they don't look like they know what they're doing.
And, that's a comforting feeling.
Oh, yeah, it is. I mean, because when I pulled up, the guy had headphones on like me. The driver did. The passenger's on his phone, not paying attention. I honk my horn. Neither of them heard me. I get my flashlight out. I flash it in their window. Finally, he's trying to get it out. They're stuck in his braids, and he can't get them out.
Oh, man.
And they didn't hear the radio when we called after the shooting happened. They took about 12 minutes to get there. They're less than a half mile away, sitting right there. Because they're like, goodness. Hey, you want me to throw you? Do we want to? Because I've always said, man, if I get shot, don't wait on an EMS. Just throw me in your car and get me to the hospital. But I knew it was raining out. I knew how cops drive. I knew the adrenaline was going. If they threw me in the back of this car, we're probably going to wreck somewhere. It's just the way it is. And I knew EMS was super close. And I knew they had more equipment than we have in our vehicles. So I was like, just wait. They're here. They're going to be here any second. Then it seemed like forever for them to show up. But when they did, you know, we got the tourniquet on me. We got down to the hospital and, you know, fortunately I was saved. But going back to Kenneth Walker, let me set the preface for this for your viewers to hear this. And this is all in the book, 12 Seconds in the Dark, plus a lot more stuff that details that we just don't have time for here tonight. But he kept saying, man, I didn't know who it was. I had no idea who it was. I thought I was getting home invaded. Well, Demarius, I don't know about you, but as a man, if I think I'm getting home invaded, I am going to grab my gun. I am going to go address the threat, but I'm not going to bring my woman with me. I'm not going to have her stand in the hall next to me. I'm going to get, baby, you call 911, stay in the room, call 911. I'll take care of this. Well, not only did he leave her hanging in the hall when he dove out of the way, he hid his gun under a bed and said he dropped it when he fell into that room. That was one of his statements. The other one was he helped her to the ground. Which, number one, he didn't have blood on her, plus where the holes were in the wall behind him, he would have been dead. So then he stated that, you know, when he called 911, first he didn't come out for 16 minutes. He stayed in the apartment 16 minutes while Brianna bled out and would not come outside to all the police commands yelling him to come out, all the sirens that had showed up by this point, because half the department showed up that night. And there's an officer that lives in this apartment complex that grew up with Kenneth, went to school with him, middle school and high school, knows Kenneth's mom. He had just gotten off to work. He was up in his apartment. He heard the gunshots. He turned his radio on and he heard an officer down. So he threw his uniform on and he came out. Well, after the scene was secured, Kenneth called his mom first. He didn't even call 911 after we came in and the shooting happened. He called his mom. Then he called 911. Then he called Brianna's mom. And when his mom showed up on scene, she went to this officer that she knew and she said, Kenneth called me and said, Mama, they're banging at the door. I don't know what they want. She's like, who's at the door, baby? He said, it's the police. I'll call you back.
Ah. Well,
that tells you right there. And the FBI only downloaded two. There were three phones there that night. They only downloaded two of them. They refused to download the third one for whatever reason. A lot of weird stuff has happened with the FBI during this case that hopefully one day we'll get the answers to, but we just don't have them right now. And so when he did that, then he finally comes out 16 minutes later, and all this is on body cam. When he comes out, they go, who else is in the apartment? He said, my girl, she's been shot. She's dead. And they said, well, where is she? Well, she's in the hallway. Okay, well, who shot? Well, she did. And they went, wait a minute, who shot? Did you shoot or did she shoot? He said, she shot. She was scared. So not only did he bring her in the hall and expose her to this danger, then he blames her for it. So that just shows you the cowardice and the lack of manhood that this guy has. And so, you know, then we're at the hospital and then everything goes from there. And you know, a couple months later, it all goes downhill.
Man. So I was reading one of the reports was saying that he called 911 saying someone's banging on my door. Is that incorrect information? Yeah.
No, he did. He called saying, man, somebody just broke in and killed my girlfriend. I don't know who it was.
Oh.
Or just shot my girlfriend. I don't know who it was.
Oh.
But obviously, he talked to his mom first. These are on phone records. He admitted calling his mom first. And when she shows up, she tells someone who's on, you know, that she knows, that she trusts, that he called and said the police are at the door. So he knew we were there. He knew it was us. Whether he knew it before the initial act or after, he still knew it was the police and then called 911. I think what happened was, personally, and I can't verify this, I think when he talked to his mom, because he talked to her for several minutes, I think they kind of got a story together. Just say you didn't hear him. Just say you didn't know who it was. That's all you got to do. And I mean, it's a good defense because how can you prove he heard us? How can you prove he knows? That's why I'm not really bitter. I don't like the way the investigation went. I think it was sloppy at parts. I think it could have been done better. But again, at the end of the day, any good defense attorney is going to be able to get him off. So the cop in me you know, detaching from the situation, detaching from me being shot, my life turned upside down, I can understand why the charges were dropped on him for that reason, because that would be a tough one to prove in court.
Man, so why did it take so long to clear the house? I mean, it's obviously a lot more of you guys there. You guess just because he was armed, you just didn't want to go in. Was that the situation?
Yeah. When there's an active shooter, you pull out because number one, we didn't know if anybody had been shot inside. Like I said, these things happened. The 12 Seconds in the Dark title of the book is the time period from when that door came open till it was totally silent from all the shots that took place. I'm in the parking lot. They're already starting to work on me. So this thing happened, unfolded very quickly. I know some of the attorneys got on there and said, this was a minute and a half gun battle. And I'm like, have you ever been in a gunfight? These things don't last. This ain't the movies. You know, this doesn't happen for a minute and a half. That's an eternity in a gun battle. We're not in Fallujah. You know, we're in an apartment complex. So, the salaciousness of all these lies that have been put out. Just last week, one of the attorneys for the case that was for her family said, he'll never be convinced differently that we weren't there to rob them. And I'm going, how does that make any sense? We did a brief with 50 people that knew exactly where we were going. Yet you think we were there to rob them? That just makes no sense.
No, that's
but
crazy.
People believe it. It's a sad part. People get online, he'll have 100 likes going, yeah, that's it. Yeah, I knew they were dirty. You know, and you're going, my goodness, this is why we can't come together as a community and police, because all these lies get put out and people just believe it. People are dumb enough to believe it. That's the sad part.
That is crazy. So what are some of the biggest lies, misconceptions?
Lies?
Yes,
yeah.
that were told.
They're straight lies. They're not misconceptions, because the people that told the lies had the evidence in hand. So originally they said we were at the wrong apartment. We were there by mistake. We didn't knock and announce. She was asleep in bed. That Jamarcus Glover had been in custody earlier that day, which is the boyfriend down on Elliott. What was some more that were told? There's like seven of them total that were just so easily disproven. You know, the only one, even though the guy upstairs said he heard us announcing, other than that, everything's documented from the fact that her name, social security number, vehicle, all are on this warrant. There's photos of him going in and out of her house, photos of her and video of her and her vehicle taking him down to the trap house. I mean, all these things are tied together. Jamarcus Glover's bank account came back in her name. His cell phone was at her address. His vehicle was registered at her address. She just bailed him out 2 months prior for gun and drug charges and used her address as his home address. So all these things saying, I remember the very first press conference the next day or the day after, her family got on there and said, she don't even know Jamarcus Glover. I don't know why they were at his apartment. Well, they've been together off and on for 7 years.
Oh, wow.
You know, and his name was tied to everything of hers. So all these things get put out. And again, when you've got such an emotionally charged event like this, because it looks bad. You've got a cop shooting an unarmed black female. So naturally, you've got the recipe for disaster. And then you add Ahmaud Arbery to it. And then you add George Floyd to it. And you had the trifecta here. And you know, it was just, and I'm sitting back going, these aren't the same. You can look at these videos. This is not the same event. This is not anything like those two other events. But people just were so energized and so already worked up over it that there was no coming back from it.
Man. So they that are telling the lies were just the people that were defending Breonna, or was that some of that your department is?
Well, here's what our department didn't do that they could have from the beginning. So everything that got put out, like from the warrant to the report that showed the jail calls after the fact, when Jamarcus Glover got locked up that night, he was in jail. He called his baby mama and said, hey, we got to get somebody to Bree's house because my money's there. I've got, I think it was $14,000, something like that. And she was ticked off. She was like, why's Bree got your money? And he's like, well, Bree holds a lot of our guys, a lot of our money. So the department refused to putting this out. Everything that got put out was leaked because people inside the department were like, my goodness, why won't you put this out? I remember calling and going, why can't we put some of this stuff out? And the answer I got was, well, we don't want to set precedent for future cases. And I was like, so you'd rather the city burn and our lives be threatened over setting precedent that you change at the whim of, at the drop of a dime anyway? You do what you want. So why not do what you want on this one that actually helps the people of Louisville and helps the country realize this is a different story than they're hearing? So it's not the fact that they put anything out, because they put nothing out. And they still haven't to this day. 26 months later, they've still never refuted one of those lies.
And that is sad because, as you said, if you put that information out, then, yeah, will you still have knuckleheads that'll say that's not true or that's a cover up? Sure.
Right.
But reasonable people would at least hear that before just assuming that, hey, you guys were all bad. So that is very, very sad and unfortunate that so much of that information didn't come out or hasn't still officially come out.
Yeah. Yep.
So how does it, one thing that's just kind of stuck with me, how does it make you feel when you look back and realize that this was all initiated by the mayor for that gentrification project?
You wonder why justice hasn't taken place there. You wonder if it ever will. You know, we're doing our best to get the story out. But again, we're getting roadblocks at every level, even still trying to push the book, trying to push the truth, trying to show people. You know, we're still working other avenues, but even the conservative media that's pro police and says the other media, the other side lies all the time. You know, you got crazy right, you got crazy left. Even those guys won't hear us out on this. You know, I talk to podcasts like yourself, but other than that, the mainstream, they don't want anything to do with it. And I don't know the answer to that either. I don't know why, because when they thought we were going to prison, which we still could because the DOJ still got an open investigation on us. But when they thought it was imminent that we were going to prison, man, everybody wanted an interview. They're like, really? Oh, please, 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 please. Calls and calls and calls. And then once the book comes out and I go, all right, here's some documented, detailed proof that that stuff was a lie. They go, yeah, you know, we got the war in Ukraine or we got Johnny Depp. That's pretty important. We need to hear this crazy trial.
That's so sickening.
That's what we're dealing with. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. You had to actually change strategies with your book because you had some pushback on even publishing your book. You want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So it was supposed to be released in September of 21. It was turned in. It was done in April of 21. I turned it in and it went through copyright and editing and all that. And the publisher that had it was a smaller publisher, kind of like the one I went with. And so they used Simon & Schuster as their distributor because they have the resources. They have the ability to put it out to Amazon to, you know, print the books, do all this stuff. Well, word got out. We had to get a copyright for a photo for the cover of the book. And when you send that in, you've got to put your name, who the author is. You got to put the title of the book, how many copies you expect to sell, all that stuff. Because if you lie on any of that, they can revoke the copyright. They can sue you and all that for their photo. Well, the photo happened to be taken by a Gannett newspaper, which is USA Today, and the Courier Journal, which is our local paper, falls underneath them. And so when that request went up, somebody from Gannett reached out to the local paper and said, hey, you know that cop that was involved, Breonna Taylor, he's doing a book. Just want to let you know. So the next day they ran a big story on it and it just exploded. And again, that's when I had right-wing media reaching out going, hey, we want an interview right now. And I'm like, well, we can't, you know, we're not allowed to talk yet. It'll come. Just give, you know, be patient with us. But so Simon & Schuster felt the pressure. They canceled the deal. My publisher at the time, great people. I still talk to him. I talked to him the other day. And he was just, his hands were tied. He had no way to get the book out. So we had to drop them and we had to go a different route, which is, you know, it's sad because it has lost a little bit of its luster from September to March. Cause you're talking 6 months and that's a big time frame in news, in a news cycle. Things just kind of die off. And so that kind of stuck us behind the eight ball a little bit. But, you know, it's getting out now and God's got a purpose. So his timing's always right. And we'll just throw it out there and let him do his thing.
Amen to that. Well, go ahead. While we're talking about the book, how can people get it? If they want to get that book, which I know I do, how can they get that book?
You can get it anywhere. You can get it online. Amazon's the easiest, obviously, but Target, Walmart. If you're out, you go to Barnes & Noble or Books A Million. They're in stock there. So you can get those physically if you're out, if you want it right away.
Okay, so you can, even though Simon & Schuster wouldn't distribute it, you did get your distribution out there because you got all the big names here.
Right.
Okay, good.
Yep, Daily Wire picked it up, and they've got an actual larger distributor than Simon & Schuster. So, and they agreed to do it, and, you know, I was kind of shocked because I was like, we'll see. You know, when things just go wrong, when something finally goes right, you're like, okay, phew. You know, one victory, I'll take it, whatever it is.
Yeah, for sure. So there's a couple of things that one thing that I had issue with as a cop. Now, I've never been in a gunfight, never been in a war. But one of the things that I was taught in the academy is you're responsible for every round that leaves your weapon. And the last thing you want to do is shoot at a target that you don't know what the target is. And I'm referring to Mr. Hankinson. And he was acquitted. Now, that surprised me that he was acquitted, because the report that I read, now you correct me if this report is wrong, is that he was shooting blindly through, I guess, a window because he felt you guys were pinned down and he was trying to lay down, I guess, suppression fire or whatever, but he didn't know what he was shooting at.
Yeah. So here's the story behind that. Brett had come up and he was going to be the third one through the door. So when I stepped up, Miles had filed in from, he was on the opposite side. So it's kind of like a zipper when you're going through a door, left, right, left, right. You kind of fill in and then you peel off right and left and you hold the longs, the hallways or whatever else. And so when I turned the corner, Miles had stepped up to go in behind me. That's when the shot went off. Well, Brett kind of turkey peeked around the corner and I guess he saw maybe when Brianna was going down, I'm not sure, but he thought for sure in his mind, he saw a long rifle. And we're inside this little foyer area. It's an eightplex, four on the bottom, four on top. So you've got four doors at the bottom. You had a metal staircase going up right beside Brianna's door. And so everything in there was super echoey. So when the gunshot started, it sounded like automatic fire is what it sounded like, because there was so much echoing going on. So when he saw me go down, he started to retreat around the corner to go to the front, because he knew approximately where they were in the hallway. And when he heard the gunfire, he didn't know I was going to be able to get out. He thought Miles and I were getting executed at the doorway. And he thought in his mind, I've got to do anything I can to get this guy inside to quit shooting so they can get out. That's what he explained to me. That's what they explained in court. And I think that's why I think you finally had some reasonable people go, okay, maybe he violated policy. Maybe, you know, we're not saying he should get his job back, but at the same time, I understand why he did what he did. And it's not anything that's unreasonable to anybody, you know, any one of us on the jury. And I think if people could see it from that standpoint, as opposed to, well, in training, we're also taught to shoot a paper target that doesn't shoot back. So when those bullets start firing, it kind of throws everything else out the window. You still revert to training. That's why I went back behind the doorway and came back around. But at the same time, you do what you have to do to get you and your guys out alive.
Yeah, I was going to follow it up and say that while reading that seemed like it was improper to do because he didn't know what he was shooting at, I'm not by any means suggesting that I would not have done the same thing had I been in his position. Because there's times where I see, you know what, I probably would have done that, but I also probably would have some consequences because of it. But it's the best decision I can make at the time.
And, you know, as a cop, a lot of our standard operating procedure is more narrow than what the courts allow. It's more narrow than what the Supreme Court has allowed. And I don't know if they do that for, money reasons where they don't want to get sued, or to keep people in check. Because if you allow people to do things, they, you know, go above and beyond. We've seen that. And so I don't know the exact reasoning other than maybe fear, scared. I don't know. But the fortunate thing was that, or the thing I'm thankful for, I'm thankful, number one, he didn't hit Brianna or Kenneth, because I think the feds, and they still could be coming after him. It sounds like they are, but, you know, we'll know here hopefully shortly. But they would definitely be just hanging him out to dry had he hit one of them. So I'm so thankful that those bullets didn't hit them. But on the second hand, I'm thankful that he was willing to put his career and his freedom on the line in an attempt to save my life.
Yeah, you can't be mad at that. Another thing, I read that there was some bad information on one of the search warrants.
So the warrant we did, here's how this went down. I had just gone to the parcel interdiction unit. I've been up a major case where we dealt with FBI, DEA, doing T3s, doing, you know, all these huge cases. I knew my career was winding down. I had been going, you know, full throttle for my entire career. My wife was like, you know, you're going to retire in 3 or 4 years. You know, what's the plan here? So I thought, well, why don't I back off a little bit? I'll still be in narcotics. I'll still get to do search warrants, but I'll go deal with interdiction, you know, boxes. They don't shoot back. I might get a paper cut, but at least I can still have fun. I can still help these other guys out on warrants, all that. So the lead investigator that's in that other unit came to me one day and said, hey, can you check this address through Postal Service and see if Jamarcus Glover has any packages coming there? He gave me 3003 Springfield number 4. So I said, Josh, I have zero contact with Postal Service. A couple of years prior to me going to that unit, there was a big rift between Postal and LMPD. and they took their ball and went home and they acted like children. And instead of mending that relationship, there was just no contact at all. So I didn't even know who ran that. I knew there was a small department that's around our city. It's within our city limits called Shavley Police Department. I knew their guys worked with them because I know those guys personally. I said, I have no contact, but I'll gladly reach out for you and see if they know anything. So I texted them on the spot with him standing there and said, hey, do you have anything here? Their sergeant replied back to me and said, I think Mike, who's one of the detectives that worked for him, he said, I think he just did a Glover and it sounds like the same name. I'll let you know. I told him that. He said, cool. About a week later, I saw Mike, the detective he was talking about out at UPS when we were interdicted packages. And I said, hey, man, did you find anything out on that case that Josh was asking about? He said, man, I've already talked to Kelly, who was the co-lead on that case. He said, I've already talked to her. We figured out it was the wrong Glover. His was like a Jamarius Glover, and this was Jamar. They were close. They're both J Glovers. So it was just a weird coincidence. And he said, but once we start talking about vehicles, I realized none of those vehicles matched up. And I told her, no, he didn't have anything there. I said, cool, not my case. I don't care. I didn't mean that in a bad way. Just I've got so much stuff going on. I can't be worried about somebody else's case. I saw Josh the next day in the hallway in passing. And I said, hey, did you talk to Kuzma? Because he said it's the wrong Glover. He said, yeah, Kelly told me. Now we've got to write all these warrants. I was hoping to just do a rip or reversal, which is where you deliver a package that you intercepted that had dope in it, and you grab the person once they take possession of that package. I said, sorry, man. You know, wish I could help you more. That was the extent of our conversation. Now, anybody that's dealt with package interdiction knows that if you're going to have a package delivered to you, you're not going to have it delivered, number one, to your address, but number two, you're not going to have it in your name. You're just going to make up a fictitious name. These guys make up UPS accounts all the time because you can get five packages delivered before they require an ID to make sure it's you. So, and Postal, UPS, FedEx, DHL, they are the largest distributors of narcotics in the country. People just ship them. UPS, there's over 3 million packages a day that come through Louisville. And we would go in and get 20 boxes and fill up a 6-foot table to the ceiling with stuff.
Wow.
So it's just constant, nonstop, these narcotics coming through because the chance of getting caught is so slim. And you don't have somebody that's going to rat on you if they do get caught. So, but these people are smart enough to not have it delivered to their name. That's why they use girls like Brianna. They take advantage of them because they're missing whatever in their life and they're needing that love. And they tell them all these things, or they pay their rent, or they do whatever they do. And they use them to hold their money, to hold their dope, to get stuff shipped to them. Now, while nothing came in Jamarcus's name, they actually have photos of him showing up to her house empty-handed where they were doing surveillance, going in, coming out with postal packages, and going down to the trap house. So the wording in the warrant said it was verified through the Postal Service, which I don't know why he put that in there. I don't know if, because this was a 2.5-month process of him creating these warrants. So my thought is usually when you're taking that long to do these warrants, as you get information, you kind of plug it in, right? You're building this framework because there's so much stuff with all the poll cams and the trackers. You've got to add all that stuff in there. So there's pages and pages of probable cause. And this one little line, the way he worded it, was incorrect. And that has caused such major confusion. And, you know, it's kind of like the devil. You get that one little bit of disinformation. You get that wedge in there. Because generally, any warrant, if it's not intentional, a lie on a warrant, if the PC, then they'll have a PC hearing, probable cause hearing, to see if that in fact should stay in the warrant. If it doesn't, because there's been mistakes before where you wrote the wrong address, like you wrote Clay Street when it's the next street up, Brook Street, but you have the exact number, you have the description of the house, you have the person of the house, just something got, you know, screwed up in the typing. And what they'll do is the judge will take that piece of information out of the warrant, and any evidence that was collected or seized based on that information is nullified. However, if the four corners of the warrant are still good, then the warrant is still valid and anything that comes from that is valid. So that's what we're dealing with now. I think there's going to be some ramifications from that. And, you know, I hate to see it for this guy because I've known him for a long time. I've never once intentionally seen him do anything that you would, you know, cause you to raise your eyebrows and go, that's weird. And that didn't even need to be in there. They had the photos of him in the warrant doing it. You know, all they had to say was he went there with no packages and came out, and this is indicative of drug trafficking XYZ. But that one little line that says verified by the postal inspector is what's going to, what caused, you know, the tree limb and the spoke of the wheel that, that threw us off the bike.
Yeah. I was just going to say it, it's unfortunate because it's it was unnecessary. You had so much other information. So,
yeah.
Yeah. So let's take a quick break and hear from our sponsor, and then we'll come back and talk a little bit about how your life has changed since all of this has gone down. And again, I apologize for the hiccups, but I had to get this guy on. We'll be right back.
It's life.
Yes, sir. So here on the 9-1-1 What podcast, we hear some crazy stories, but none are crazier than some of the stories that hear at Eric Buchanan and Associates. The lengths that some insurance companies will go to deny your disability insurance claim are amazing. If you've been denied your disability insurance, then you need to call my friend Eric Buchanan and his team at Eric Buchanan and Associates. The number is 877-634-2506. That's 877-634-2506, or find them on the web at buchanandisability.com. Eric Buchanan and Associates, helping people who are denied disability, life, long-term care, and health insurance nationwide. As you look around your home, what's missing? Don't see it? Call the Blind Lady. She can see it. The Blind Lady, Chattanooga's premier window covering company, locally owned and operated, serving you for over 35 years. The Blind Lady is Chattanooga's only window covering showroom representing all major brands of blinds, shades, shutters, and fabrics, including Hunter Douglas. When you're ready to transform your windows into something beautiful, call the Blind Lady at 423-877-1000. That's 423-877-1000, or online at blindlady.net. Call the Blind Lady. She'll see you through it. Welcome back to 9-1 What? My guest today is Sergeant John Mattingly, retired from the Louisville Metro Police Department. And, you know, you probably recognize his, his name mostly from his involvement with the Breonna Taylor case. Now, you know, it even sounds funny for me to say, to ask you how your life has changed, because I know there's people that are listening today says, well, what about Breonna? She doesn't, she has no life now. But the fact remains that you are still here, and it's, there's been a lot of change and just a lot going on as a result of this case. Tell us about it.
So, you know, COVID hit on and the nation shut down on March 13th, which was the day this tragedy happened. And so initially I thought, well, maybe, you know, it won't get as much national news or even local news, because president was on every day. The mayor was on every day. The governor was on every day. It was just all consuming. COVID was. But that didn't last long. Like we talked earlier, Ahmaud Arbery happened. Ben Crump got on that case. The lawyer for the family, Breonna Taylor, had worked a previous case with him when she was in law school. So she reached out and said, hey, would you mind getting some exposure for our case? And he was like, sure. You know, money talks. I'm jumping right on it. I didn't even know this existed, but here we go. And then you had less than a month later, the whole incident with George Floyd, that again was horrible, number one, but number two, Ben Crump was on that case. So now you had this guy who had all the national spotlight on him because of these events, some tragedies, some just bad policing, some not even have to do with police. You know, when you're talking about Georgia, that had nothing to do with police, but just like Trayvon Martin, it all gets lumped together and then we get blamed for it. And so when this happened, all of a sudden, you know, chaos just erupted. I remember the first nights the riots happened in Louisville, and I'm sitting in my bed watching it. Man, I could feel a sweat going down my armpits, because I know those poor guys, they didn't ask for any of this. You know, they're just doing their job. And now they're all stuck out there on the front line, getting stuff thrown at them, cussed at. And there were seven people shot in that first night of protest in Louisville. Mm. And so you could see where this thing was going, and it wasn't good. And I thought, well, okay, at least at this point, somebody's going to get out ahead of this and say, hey, guys, hold on. I understand you're mad. I understand you're upset. But let's at least get some of these facts out. Then if you still want to feel that way, that's up to you. But let's give you a chance to see, because it wasn't just the black community. It was the white community. It was old. It was young. It didn't matter. Everybody was mad, and everybody was coming together. And rightfully so on some of the incidents.
Yeah, and rightfully so based on what they had been told about this incident.
Right. Yeah, because you had, at this point, you had over 2 months, 2.5 months had gone by. And I remember reaching out in mid-May before all this exploded, because you could start to feel the tension in the air. You could start feeling things ramp up. I reached out to our city council president, David James, who was a retired cop. He was the trainer in the academy that trained me. He taught some of our search warrants classes on how to do this stuff. And when he's now the city council president, and he's a black guy, and we were friends. And I reached out to him and said, David, I sent him a text and said, here's all the things that are lies. And I laid them all out. And I said, here's exactly the truth, and it's proven. And I laid that all out. I said, what can you do? I need help, because the mayor's obviously not going to do it. The chief isn't going to do it. You're in a position of authority. You can do something. Please help. He responded back, yeah, the mayor's a coward, or the mayor's something. I'll do a press conference Monday. This was like on a Friday. And in the back of my mind, I was like, you know, at least we got a little bit of the cavalry's coming. We got a little bit of help. Well, the next week and the week after, now all of a sudden he's on the news dogging us too, when he had the information at his hands. And so I'm going, my goodness, if I can't even get help from so-called friends, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
And so all this stuff picked up. And I remember May 31st, I think the protest started May 27th. I think it's what it was. May 31st, the FBI calls us and says, or the task force officer with the FBI calls and says, hey, you guys have to get out of your house, you and your family. There's been some credible death threats that we've been able to corroborate through two different informants. One worked for the ATF, one worked for Louisville Narcotics. And these two informants don't know each other, but they're both tied into the same motorcycle gang that Breonna Taylor's mom's tied into, which runs drugs and guns and is very violent. And they got together with another motorcycle gang in town, and they're hiring Sin City out of Chicago to come kill you guys. They're giving them $50,000. And I'm like, oh, you know, this is movie stuff. What is going on here?
Man.
So I asked the department, the representative, I called my boss's boss. I'm like, what do we do? And they're like, well, you know, we've got I'll tell you what, we'll put you in a hotel downtown, because we got a contract with them. Right in the middle of these riots. I mean, like dead center of these riots. And I'm going, yeah, thanks, but no thanks. I'll pass on that one. So fortunately, I reached out to a friend who had a place a couple hours away that was big enough for my entire family. Because at this point, everybody had been doxxed. My family, my parents, my sisters, all that. So we all went to this location a couple hours away. And the sad thing is, so I don't know if you've worked much with the FBI, but once they open a case, they don't close it. Like I said, 26 months later, they're still investigating us. They're still interviewing people, re-interviewing people on our case, hoping to find something. And 10 days later, they closed the case on this because they said the optics looked bad going after a national victim's mother. And there's still been no resolution to this. We filed Freedom of Information Act. We've called senators. We've done all this stuff. And the FBI just says, we're not giving it to you. They won't even talk to me. They want to interview me to see if we're guilty of stuff. But when I kept reaching out saying, hey, I'm a victim on this part. You know, there's two separate cases here. The one where you're looking at me as a suspect, but then this one's separate. Mm-hmm. I'm a victim in this case. Don't victims have any rights? Where's your victim advocate? How come they haven't reached out to me? Where's a case number? Where's anything? Refused to talk to me. Treated us like we were the ones that took the hit out on somebody. So that's where we stand with that. There's just been a lot of feelings of, man, I gave 21 years to this profession thinking that this thin blue line existed that doesn't exist. You know, it sounds good. It's all theory, but it doesn't come to fruition when the rubber meets the road and people are pushed in a corner. People go, I want nothing to do with
every
it.
Man for himself.
That wouldn't call us. Oh yeah. I requested meetings with my chief. Nothing. Nope. Can't do it. And so we were treated like we were a pariah. We were put on an island, and it's something that I don't want anybody else to go through. And that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. This book isn't a pity party about John. It tells my story, but this isn't about that. This is a wake up call for America, because if you keep doing this to police officers who are willing to go in these communities and risk their lives for you, what are you going to be left with? Detroit and New Orleans of the 80s, where it's all corrupt again? We don't want that. Like we talked earlier, I think this is the most professional policing's ever been. And I would hate to take a big step back, because you're not going to recoup from that. Or if you do, it's going to take 15, 20 years to do that. And we're already being defunded without the stroke of a pen, simply by the DOJ constantly coming after our DAs, coming after cops for things that you trained us to do, for things you asked us to do. And then you're going to come and attack us and threaten us with our freedom over this. And so most guys, you know, you got your good ones that have options going, this ain't worth it. My family's worth more to me than this career or this calling. And it's sad that we're in that position because I don't want to go back there. I've got kids and grandkids. I don't want them to grow up in an America that's lawless or has, you know, the law enforcement like down in Mexico where you're going, man, if I get pulled over, are they going to, you know, take money from me? What, you know, what's going on here?
That is so true. And that's, ironically, that's why I left the department in 1995, you know, that long ago, because I saw officers in my department that were getting suspended or, you know, fired for doing exactly what they were trained to do. And something may have looked bad and the right people complained and the department was like, well, okay, well, we'll punish them. Not near to the extent that it is now, but enough for me even then to say, yeah, I could, I don't need this. So I hear you loud and clear. So how long after March 13th, 2020, did you retire or quit or whatever you want to call it?
Retired on May 31st of 21. So it was a month and what, it was 14 months.
Now, did you go back on the job during that time?
Well, I finally went back. When this happened, the first thing I told my wife in the hospital was like, I'm going to recoup as hard as I can. I'm going to recover. The first thing I do when I go back is I'm going to go through a door. I'm going to do a search warrant. You know, this ain't going to beat me because the fear wasn't there of that. You know, just the disappointment of not hitting the right guy, you know, in the scenario and all that stuff just messes with your head. And, but then when all this happened, I knew, oh, I thought, man, those, the chances of that happening, you know, of them or me even willing to put my name out there now that my family's all been threatened. I mean, because there were some nasty threats coming in. And, but when I finally went back to the apartment, I said, you know what, I'm going to go back. I'm going to do what I can. I'll stay out of the limelight as much as I can, but you know, I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't commit a crime. I didn't violate a policy. So I'm going to go back and do what I can for my family. And I went back to work and I showed up and my boss at the time slid me a piece of paper and said, sorry, man, this is out of my hands. You're being involuntarily transferred to the property room. And I said, what for? You know, I'm on a federal task force. I've got this guaranteed overtime. I got all these things in play. I've got a good group of guys working for me. Why am I being punished? He said, just for the good of the department. That's all I can tell you. And this is the same chief that I'd requested two interviews with, and she turned me down. This is the same chief that came from Atlanta that in her very first press conference said, you know, Breonna Taylor was killed in her sleep. And this just doesn't, this shows the racism that goes on. This wouldn't happen in a white community. And they wouldn't do this to a white family in the middle of the night. I'm going, wait a minute, Breonna Taylor's apartment was in a white community. You know, she wasn't asleep in her bed. You had months to prepare for this job and you knew what you were getting into. You already screwed stuff up in Atlanta. Now you come here and your very first press conference is this. So I saw the writing on the wall. I knew I wasn't wanted here. The mayor had already said many times if he could fire me, he would. The only thing that saved me from getting fired or indicted was getting shot. And, you know, it's sad that it's got to come to that. So I knew the writing was on the wall and I knew it was in the best interest of my family. Plus, I was ready to explode. I couldn't talk about this being on the department and I knew they weren't going to talk about it. So I thought, you know what? If it requires me stepping away from something I love to help other people or to get this story out, then that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah, I forgot in all of this because we talked about at the very beginning that you took a life-threatening shot. I mean, like I said, you could have bled out from a femoral artery. So how long did it take?
5-hour surgery.
Ah, and how long did you take to recoup from that?
It took about 2.5 months to get back, and my leg's still numb. There's still pain in the knee because when I went from the apartment area there to the sidewalk, I'd stepped off a curb just out of habit. You know, you go step down and I stepped off with my left leg and the muscle wasn't working in it because it had been ripped through. And I just went down and twisted that knee and that took, the knee took longer to recover than the actual gunshot wound.
Now, did you realize when you got shot that you'd gotten shot or was it, you know, once you kind of sat down and felt the blood? Okay. Cause you kept moving and operating.
Yeah. Yeah, it was because I thought, man, if he shot once, he could shoot again. I don't want to be a sitting duck here. So it was just reaction. But yeah, as soon as it hit, man, it was like a sledgehammer to the leg and that burn that people talk about. Same thing.
Go ahead.
How long to what? I was going to say, number one, the tourniquet hurt worse than the gunshot. It was on almost 40 minutes and that sucker is no fun. I wouldn't want to do it again. But the pain of the betrayal by the department and city hurt a lot worse than getting shot. And that recovery is going to take a lot longer than 2.5 months that the gunshot wound took to heal.
Yeah, those emotional scars take a lot longer to heal, especially like that. Now, how long did your family have to stay in hiding?
My parents stayed for about 6 months. Now, my kids had to go back to work. You know, one of them has kids. The other one is, she gets married actually this weekend. And so they've got jobs. One of them owns a business. And so they had to get back to their life. Now, they had some security on them for a few months. But that unknown of knowing there's a threat there, but the unknown of where it's at, what's taking place, are bank accounts being monitored? Because you got to remember, when Breonna Taylor's mom got that $12 million, plus she got almost $8 million in GoFundMe, now all of a sudden, that $50,000 hit is nothing when you've got $20 million. Now we can up that. Now this thing can get real serious. So in the back of my mind, I'm constantly, you know, you're so hyper vigilant. You try not to be paranoid. But then all of a sudden, my youngest kid's affected by it. He's having night terrors. He's going, and you try to keep him protected, but it was everywhere. I don't care if it was on the, you turn the radio on, they talked about it. You turn the news on, they talked about it. Because the protests in Louisville lasted over a year. Every single day, the poor cops were out there frontlining it, dealing with these idiots that were just out of control. And the city would go, okay, now we're not going to put up with it anymore. And they would let them be police for like 2 hours and then go, pull back. And then chaos. And then they would do it again 2 weeks later. Then, pull back. And it was a joke. I mean, and the bad guys know that. They're not dumb. They pick up on these rhythms and these things pretty quick.
Right, right. So how's your life today? Are you still having to look over your shoulder or your family?
Yeah, I'll tell you what. We went into town because we never moved back. We had just bought a house. We'd only been in it 5 weeks. We ended up selling it, moved. We moved six times within that first few months. So while I'm not in Louisville, not anywhere close, the other day I was in town to visit and two people recognized me within the matter of about 10 minutes when we were out. And it's just uncomfortable. One of them was friendly. One of them was not. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you just don't know what you're dealing with. So it's always like you're just, you know, your head's just constantly on a swivel. And that'll emotionally wear you down. And I'll tell you what, it doesn't affect me as much as it affects my kids and my wife. Because 21 years, you get kind of used to people threatening you and cussing you and right. yelling at you. Like, yeah, whatever. You get kind of calloused.
Yeah.
And plus we're all so type A. We're like, that's fine. Bring it on. You know, yeah. I'll handle my own. Let's go. But they're not built that way. They're just not. And it's not their fault. They just, that's not them. And so not only are you watching out, but then you're emotionally trying to bring them in and say, hey, everything's going to be all right. You know, there's only so much we can control, and what we can't was leave up to God and go from there. So there's still a lot of that looking over your shoulder, which is uncomfortable, but you know, that's just, I guess, what they call the new normal, like everything yeah. else.
Well, you should just come on to Tennessee. We'll take care of you.
I'm not too far from you.
Okay. No, we won't talk about it anymore. So one other thing.
Southern Kentucky is a big area.
Yeah, yes, it is. Do you think that it's a good idea to have stand your ground laws and no knock warrants in the same city?
Yes. So again, this wasn't a no knock warrant.
Yes, I know this wasn't.
You and I would not be talking. And no knock warrants don't go bad very often. Not any worse than regular warrants because I've been shot at doing regular warrants. I've had my buddy shot doing regular warrants. I've had SWAT guys even shot at doing regular warrants. So this is the first no knock, even though it wasn't a no knock, that has been equated in the city of Louisville to this. Now, sort of like the one up in Minneapolis that just happened not too long ago with those murder suspects. Do you know which one I'm talking about?
I'm not familiar.
The covers and he came out. Okay. Well, there was one there recently that I know the lieutenant up there who is the guy in charge of the guy who shot that suspect. And there were so many lies again in that their department's not putting out. And I think this one's been originally it was very controversial because it was a no knock warrant. And it really was. But you got to realize on no knock warrants, you always announce. I have never done or been involved with anybody doing a no knock warrant that you don't announce. As soon as that ram hits the door or as soon as you get access to that door, whether it's by key, it's instantly police search warrant. You're yelling it because you don't want people to think they're getting robbed. You want them to know you're the police. The whole thing, the whole idea behind no knock is it gives you just that extra 10 seconds of surprise. It's kind of like unmarked cars. You know, I was in that 15 years of my career. after a couple passes, they know you're the police. Or after a couple of times you've been in a neighborhood, you can't constantly be switching your cars out. However, it still gives you that couple seconds advantage of them. What, wait, is it? Oh, crap, it's the police.
Yeah.
As opposed to the big light bar coming down your way.
Right.
And I think now would you say, John, would you ever do one for drugs again? Heck no, it's not worth it. But is any warrant worth it now that I look back on drugs? I don't know. But if you're talking about murder suspects or you're talking about hostage situations, man, they're vital. There's a place for them. Let me just put it that way.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad I asked that question.
But I'm for stand your ground laws. I mean, I'm a 2A guy to the core, and that's why I said I'm not bitter about Kenneth Walker not being charged, because I understand how in a court of law that would play out, and I don't ever want that to detract from legal, law-abiding citizens having that same right.
Great. And one of the things that I read that you said in an interview really struck me, and that is, I don't want another Breonna Taylor or another John Mattingly.
Right. Yeah. I mean, again, that goes back to the tragedy of the biggest fear in cops, at least the ones I've talked to, is being in one of these instances where an unarmed person's hit by gunfire or a target that you're not intended gets hit, because that family suffers tragedy. I don't care what kind of lifestyle they live. That's still a human being. That's still a daughter. That's still a friend, a sister. And you don't want that for them, because you know what you feel like. You know the love you have for your family. Or you don't want me for the simple fact I know what it did to my family. I know what it's done to my friends even, or my department or city, or all the aftermath. Because we've had a couple of cops get indicted federally for stuff that happened during the riots. You know, you put these guys out there for 200 days straight, and they're getting just abused. And then somebody snaps one day. Now they're in prison. And so you feel a little bit of that survivor's guilt with that stuff, because you're going, man, had I just hit the intended target, or if we had done something, if we'd moved faster, if we hadn't given it a minute at the door, if we'd just done the normal thing we do, would anybody be in this situation? Would those seven people have been shot? Would the two cops that were shot during the riots in Louisville, would that have happened? You know, there's a lot of peripheral effect that took place after this that you just look back on and question a lot of things and going, what could we have done different?
Yeah.
And it's a tough call.
Isn't that ironic, though, that part of the reason we're having this conversation is because you guys were giving extra time?
Yeah, it sucks, because you do go, every time in my career that I've done something against what I was trained to do, or what has been common protocol that I've done over and over and over and over, or something that just I went, I don't know about this, but somebody else that's over me is telling me to do it, you've got to do it, then it seems like it's always gone just a little bit south.
Yeah.
This one just went, the wheels came off. And it makes you think, man, if I had just done what I always do,
yeah,
we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, that's so ironic. It's so ironic. Well, Sergeant Mattingly, I really, really do appreciate you coming and joining my show. And it's certainly been eye-opening for me. And I've read into it a little bit, and I know a little bit more than a lot because of my time on the police department. So I'm certain that this is going to be very informative to the rest of my listeners. But I would like to invite you back when I don't have the hiccups, and we can talk more about the other crazy stuff you've experienced in your 20-year career, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Yeah. Well, again, thank you so much.
Appreciate you having me, DeMarlo.
Man, I appreciate you. I appreciate you very much. And I appreciate all of you all listening. And don't forget, as I always ask you, to make sure you follow us and, give us a good rating out there on the Apple Podcast, and subscribe wherever you may be listening, so you know when the next episode's coming out. And most importantly, share it with your friends. Force them all to listen to the 911 What Podcast. And John, thank you so much, sir. And I hope you have an amazing night.
Thanks, buddy. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to 911 What? We hope you enjoyed the show. If you have comments or suggestions, please email us at 911what.podcast@gmail.com. And thanks to Carlos Bail Bonding and Eric Buchanan and Associates for making this episode possible.